Good morning. I see there are two reserved seats in here if anybody wants to sit in those reserved seats. One of them is for me, but I can't bilocate. I'm working on it. Does anybody want to come in here? Two seats. So in the last talk I gave, I quoted Helen Keller at the beginning. Helen Keller, the blind, deaf writer, who said, "Security is mostly a superstition. It does not exist in nature, nor do the children of humans as a whole experience it." So 11 or 12 of us, I've lost count, have been sitting here in retreat since Friday night. Sitting and walking and walking and sitting and eating and sitting and walking and sitting and sleeping, right? That's all we've been doing. So we've been practicing. Our practice is to return to our still, timeless nature. So we can be the peace we deeply need for ourselves and others in a time of insecurity. Anybody think this is a time of security? It's a time of insecurity. And there will be other times of insecurity too. There have been other times. You may not remember them, but there have been. So that's what we're doing. And we're practicing what in the earliest Pali scripture they say, standing or sitting firm and immovable as an anvil when it is beaten upon. Have you been feeling beaten upon, Matt, during these last 2 days? A little bit. A little bit. Here we are just sitting equanimously and we're feeling beaten upon. Well, all our thoughts, all our worries, when do we get to go to the bathroom, when do we get to eat, how many more minutes is this city going to take? We're beaten upon, right? But we sit strong and firm as an anvil. We may not feel like an anvil inside, but we do it. That's our practice. We've been doing that for a long, long time. And yesterday, I gave some instruction in classical Buddhist meditation, which is focus. Two components of classical Buddhist meditation: focus, concentration, and openness or bare awareness or whatever you want to call it. Bare attention, or focus and openness. And there are lots of different Buddhist terms that we can go on and on. So I gave instruction on that. And with the openness, we can feel these afflictive states that come into our mind. Instead of chattering on and on about them, just feel them, just be with them. And let them go. And if they won't go, let them be. And they actually dissolve. They actually do dissolve. They do on their own. Not when we interfere, but on their own. On their own. So today I want to talk about four teachings from the golden age of Chinese Zen. Some of you didn't even know there was a golden age of Chinese Zen. Oh, hi, David. A golden age of Chinese Zen from the 7th century through the 10th century. This is when the most Zen teachers, the most lively expression of Zen in the arts, in poetry, in everyday life, took place. Before it got too institutionalized. We're starting to get institutionalized here. We better be careful. Because institutions tend to confine and retract, and so need to keep the spirit alive. So the golden age of Chinese, I'm going to talk about four teachings about this timeless, peaceful nature, called Buddha nature, or called whatever, from this golden age. It was called Chan, but the Chinese call it the Chan Buddhism. So the first one, a monk asked, "What is the mind of the ancient Buddhas?" Yanyang said, "Walls, tiles, and pebbles." The monk said, Aren't walls, tiles, and pebbles without consciousness? Nyanyang said, that's right. The monk said, then how can they teach the Dharma? They are brilliantly teaching the Dharma constantly and without end. I've never been able to hear it, said the monk. That you don't hear doesn't mean others can't hear it, said Nanyang. I don't understand, said the monk. Who hears it? Someone who is at peace does, says the teacher. Someone who's at peace does. Which reminds me of a story about John Cage. How many of you know are familiar with John Cage? A few of you. Less people than used to be, because he's been dead since 1992. John Cage, the experimental musician. So John Cage was in the late 1950s kind of studying Zen, practicing Zen, trying to practice Zen, and with D.T. Suzuki in New York. Actually, he was going to talks that D.T. Suzuki gave every week at Columbia University in New York. And John Cage was a musician at the time, and he was taken with the teaching that D.T. Suzuki was talking about with the classical age of Chinese Zen. Most teachers talk about that when they talk. I guess I shouldn't spend too much time because I got to go through my talk. But most of our Japanese teachers, that's what they talked about, the teachings from those times, from the 7th century through the 10th century. Anyway, so he was teaching about that. Only problem was, and I don't really know where Columbia University is, but in those days, the planes would come overhead. There was an Air Force base around there or something, I don't know. The planes would come overhead, and D.T. Suzuki had a very small voice. Very small voice. And so John Cage would hear D.T. Suzuki for a while, and then the planes would come, and he'd miss it. And so he tried sitting up closer. But when he sat up closer, it seemed like D.T. Suzuki's voice was smaller and smaller. and he was very frustrated, but he kept coming back. Until one time when he was listening to the talk and the planes, he really heard the planes. And they didn't interfere with the talk. There was a words, and then there was the planes, and then there were more words, and then there were more planes. He let go of trying to get anything from that talk, of trying to learn anything or become someone. It just was there. And then love coming to the talks. At least this is according to this is what he wrote. I don't know if you want to believe him or not. And then his whole approach to music changed. His whole approach to music changed, which is another talk in and of itself. If you follow experimental music, you probably have. His whole approach changed, but he felt some peace. He felt some peace by letting go of the desire to get anything and not tuning out. Usually, when we let go of the desire to get something, we tune out. But he tuned in. He tuned in, and he was. Well, he said it changed his life. It changed his life. So that's what we're doing here. We're hearing the teaching that's always right here and there. Planes, we don't have too many planes here. Sometimes in the walls, in the floors, in the tiles, in the pebbles. The teaching. Which is not trying to teach. It's just being. It's just being. Well, that's the first story. First story. The second story from the Golden Age. Layman Pong. So this is a story about Layman Pong. There's a whole book about Layman Pong. P-A-N-G. Mostly these were teachers even then were mostly priests and monks. Well, people had to work really long hours, and they didn't have time to do meditation. I mean, I think that's why. I don't really know. But Layman Pong was an exception. He was well off financially. well enough off so that he could have a little meditation hut, which he built in the backyard, and went every day to his little meditation hut. One room, supposedly, right in back of his family home where he lived with his wife and his daughter. So one day he was doing a solo retreat in his meditation hut. And of course, in his solo retreat, it's just you. So you can do stuff that isn't acceptable in our retreats. Totally unacceptable. So one day during one of his retreats, he stormed out of his little hut, yelling, "Difficult, difficult, difficult." It's like trying to store sesame oil on the leaves of a tree. And his wife heard him, and she said, "Easy, easy, easy. Buddha nature reflected in every drop of dew in the grass." And his daughter heard the wife, and she said, gently, "Not difficult, not easy. When I'm hungry, I eat. When I'm tired, I sleep." So, talk about that one a little bit. So this retreat, as all retreats, and I've been doing retreats for a long time, it's difficult. It's been difficult. If it hasn't been difficult for people, they've been just, I don't know, totally out of it. Totally out of it. It's difficult. About 3 weeks ago, I saw a couple of people looking at the sign-up board for the retreat out there, and there were about 10 people signed up, and a woman I didn't know said, "Well, aren't they brave? Aren't they brave?" So our retreats have a reputation, I guess. You've got to be brave. Well, you know, we're here at 5:45 in the morning. That's brave, I guess. Brave. So, difficult, difficult. It's like trying to store sesame oil on the leaves of a tree. Well, that's an interesting analogy. Well, the leaves of the tree, they're always quaking, just like our thoughts. They're always quaking. And there are lots of leaves. There are more leaves than we imagine when we sit down. And they're quaking, they're shivering, and we're trying to smooth them over with sesame oil. But there are always some leaves that are still quaking. We don't have enough sesame oil. We can't soothe them with our loving kindness. There are some leaves that just quake, quake, quake. So it's difficult. It's difficult. And if you do a solo retreat, you can just get up and yell. Of course, you could do that here, too, but not too many people dare to do that. That would be really brave, wouldn't it? That would take bravery beyond bravery. Especially in front of me, the guiding teacher. But on the other hand, his wife says, "Easy, easy, easy, easy. Just one breath, and then another breath. Three good meals. The wonderful cook preparing our meals. I don't see her, but she's somewhere around here. There was Anne. A wonderful, really good meals. Tasty. We don't have to think about fixing a peanut butter sandwich or anything. Just taken care of. Three good meals. Yoga every day. A walk on the lake, by the lake every day. Oh, easy. Just one activity and then another. Don't need to anticipate. Don't need to worry about doing the last one wrong. Of course you did it wrong. No big deal. No big deal. If you just enjoy doing things wrong, you'll be okay. You'll be okay." It doesn't mean to make effort, not to make effort. It means making effort, but not getting tangled up. Not getting tangled up. Because each of our activities is supported by what we call Buddha nature, the still nature that emanates from the walls and the floor and the sky and each other. However, the minute we think easy, wonderful, everything is cool, well, the next minute, we're going to be in pain. Or maybe we're just closed down to the pain. There's always pain. Someone is in pain. The pain of the universe, the pain of the political realm, the pain of our friend, the pain of our own aching body as it ages, the pain of our out-of-control mind. Not enough sesame oil for all these leaves. Need more sesame oil. Tim taught me about how to say this loving kindness to myself, but I can't do it. It's too much, et cetera, right? So then the daughter has the last word, although it's not necessarily the last word. But anyway, in this case, she has the last word. So how about it? Not difficult, not easy. It's like eating when hungry, sleeping when tired. Completely engrossed in each activity, rather than completely engrossed in evaluating and judging. Think about how much time you spend evaluating and judging. And think about how much time you spent actually in the activity. If you could just, you can just through your practice, you will move the barometer. The barometer will move on its own. You won't move it. If you move it, it gets all messed up. But the barometer will move. So instead of spending 80 to 90% of your time judging, evaluating, criticizing, and only 10 to 20%, 10 to 15% being in this moment, the barometer will move. And it moves more slowly than you want it to. But it moves. So that after a while, you're more alive with whatever. The pebbles, the stones, your friend, your pain, you're more alive. So that's why we always say in Zen, when you eat, just eat. When you sleep, just sleep. When you sit, just sit. And that's the standard Soto Zen kind of teaching, right? For those of you who've done Soto Zen, that's the standard teaching. So, and especially we heard this from our Japanese teachers. So this one friend of mine was hanging out with his Japanese teacher, and his teacher was, you know, he would come in and say stuff, try to get support from his teacher, and his teacher mostly would end by saying, well, just do your activity. Just do it. Whatever it was. So then the student one day barged in on the teacher inadvertently, thinking the teacher wasn't in his office. Maybe to clean his office. I don't know. He barged in, and there was the teacher reading the newspaper, drinking a cup of coffee, let's say listening to the radio, let's say eating a sandwich. I don't remember exactly. And the student said, but you said, when you eat, just eat. When you read the newspaper, just read the newspaper. When you do the, just do this. And the teacher said, good, just eating, drinking coffee and reading a newspaper. Do you get it? Do you get it? We're so rigid. We want to do it right. What's not right? What's not right? The third teaching. This is a long interchange. And I wanted to put it in the program, but I thought there wasn't space enough. So, this is an interchange with Dongzhan. Dongzhan is considered the founder of Soto Zen in China. And there's a new book about Dongzhan by Taigen Layton. Dongzhan's teaching. Founder of our school of Zen. When Dongzhan was holding a memorial feast for Yunyuan, a monk asked, when you practice with Master Yunyuan, what kind of instructions did you receive? Dongzhan said, although I practiced with him, I didn't receive any instructions. The monk said, since you didn't receive any instructions, why are you offering this feast? Dongshan replied, how could I turn away from him? You first practiced with Nanquan, so why hold the feast for Yunyan? It's not that I value Yunyan's virtue, says Dongshan, or his Buddha Dharma. I just value that he did not try to teach me something. Oh, says the monk, by holding a feast for your teacher, are you accepting him? Dongshan said, half accept, half not. The monk said, why not accept him entirely? Dongshan said, if I accept him entirely, I diminish him. Well, that's the story. So I'm going to unpack that a little bit here. Okay. Although I practiced with my teacher, I didn't receive any instruction. So my teacher wasn't trying to shape me. Wasn't trying to give me a new shape, but help me return to my original shapelessness. So anything he instructs me about how to meditate, as I was to people yesterday, gives them something to worry about, something to think about, something to try to do right, something to evaluate, something to criticize, right? So both of my teachers, Suzuki Roshi and Katagiri Roshi, were in this lineage, this Soto lineage. And they gave us very little instruction in meditation, almost zero, even when we asked, almost zero. And of course, they talked about Shikan Taza, but they never explained it. And then they just had us read Dogen, but that confused us more. So the teaching that I gave yesterday, it's a good teaching, but take it with a grain of salt and don't worry about getting it right. Just engage. Just engage. The monk said, since you didn't receive any instructions, why are you offering the feast? Well, why do we want to honor a teacher who doesn't instruct us, who doesn't give us anything? Dongshan said, how could I turn away from him? How could I turn away from him? So, in the case of my own teachers, would I love them and respect them more if they taught me some meditation technique? What do you want to be instructed in? What does Tim want to be instructed in? I want security. I want a sense of direction. But as long as I'm grabbing for security and a sense of direction, I'm not paying attention to this spaciousness that's here. It's always here. So the tiles and the floors are preaching the Dharma, just because they are, just because things are. A mind that's really fasting, and that's what we do in our retreats and with our meditation, even if you're only sitting for 20 minutes, you're fasting, shouldn't feed on instruction at all, because we're fasting from trying to get anything. Just being here, fasting. So I tried reading the Dogen when my teacher said, didn't give me any instruction. This is really true. And I read Fukan Zazengi, and he talks all about posture, sitting straight. That's what they all talked about, sitting straight and having your hands like this. But then I kept waiting to learn about how to meditate. And Dogen says, the sitting that I teach isn't meditation. It isn't meditation. And then finally the instructions at the end are, think non-thinking. What? And then he says, well, how do you do that? How do I do that? And he says, by non-thinking. And that's the end of Fukan Zazengi. That's the end. This is the Soto lineage. This is my lineage. But I only half do the lineage, because that's what I get to half do my own thing, right? But it's pretty wonderful. It's pretty wonderful. Usually we turn away from someone who we can't get something from, right? That's what we do. If we can't get something, we get bored or we turn away. Unless we're trapped, like you're trapped in a retreat, you made the commitment, you've got to do the next 3 hours, you're embarrassed to to say, difficult, difficult, and run home. So when I practiced as a young man, there weren't other Buddhist teachers around. So I was this was the only guy in San Francisco. I mean, there may have been another guy, but I looked all over. And I was impatient because he didn't teach me how to meditate. Get your butt on the cushion and keep your back straight and put your hands like this. But I couldn't go anyplace else because he was the only one. So here I am. So is that wonderful or awful? I don't know. It seems wonderful to me, actually, now. But at the time, it seemed awful. What's wonderful and what's awful? I don't know. So I had a friend who went to Japan to study Zen carpentry. And you know, there are lots of different Zen disciplines in Japan. And Zen carpentry is one of them. No nails. No nails. And so my friend was excited, and he was not a very good friend of mine, but I had known him in our Zen monastery, California, and he wanted to become a Zen carpenter, and of course, he wanted technique. He went all the way over to Japan. Not an easy country to go to. Not an easy language, not an easy culture, very different culture from ours. So the first year, his master, you know, they call them masters, taught him to sweep, sharpen tools, and observe for a year. That's all he did for a year. And finally he wrote me, he said, my God, thank God that year is up. Now they're finally going to teach me how to do this thing, I think. Then he wrote back. He didn't write me. He wrote my friend. And he said, this is very odd. I was given my first wood, and I was blindfolded and not told anything except to work on projects to plane them, to smooth them, and to square them. And that's all I said. That's all I said. So when we don't rely on our thinking, we really have to go in and be still, and we really have to open our senses. Even if our mind's not still, it actually becomes still if we're not thinking. And so my friend, I don't know. I never lost track of him. I don't know if he stayed or became a master carpenter or what. Doing something without relying on thinking is hard for us. It's hard for us. So the monk says, I'm still in the story, you guys. You first practice with non-kwan. So why hold the feast for Yunyan? It's not that I value Yunyan's virtue or his Buddha Dharma. I just value that he did not try to teach me something. He didn't interfere with my mind fasting. I didn't like mind fasting. I wanted Suzuki to give me instruction. But he didn't interfere with it. Didn't give me a lot of new ideas. Give me any ideas and concepts about how to manage this body-mind that's out of control on the cushion. And that's why I honor him. In a way, that is why I honor both of them. In a way. So then the interchange ends. By holding a feast for your teacher, are you accepting him? Asked the monk. Dongshad said, half accept, half not. The monk asked, why not accept him entirely? Dongshan said, if I accept him entirely, I diminish him. When we accept someone entirely, our relationship freezes. It's not you turn me, I'll turn you. It's a frozen relationship. That person has the knowledge. And there's just me. Or I have the knowledge, and there's that person. It's not alive. It loses the dynamism of life. So half accept, not half, not accept. Pretty good. Give and take. That makes any relationship valuable. Think about a relationship that really works for you. Isn't there give and take? Isn't there a lot of give and take? Isn't there a lot of back and forth? A lot of giving and receiving? That's what really love is, isn't it? Giving and receiving, receiving or giving. So, in the early days of my practice, we revered this guy, Suzuki. We revered him, and people still actually revere him. When I knew him, he was not famous, but we revered him anyway. I don't know why. We thought he had some wisdom that we wanted. that we wanted. And he did. He did. I do. But so do you. Give and take, right? Give and take. people at the monastery I lived in, they saw that he had a shaved head, so they all started shaving their heads. They saw that he was wearing a robe, so they wanted to sew robes and started wearing their own robes. They saw that he went like this all the time, so they started going like this all the time. They noticed that he spoke with broken English, and they started speaking with broken English. It's true. It's true. I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding. That's what we do. We're scared. We want security. We find someone who's got it, and then we become like little imitators. Little imitators. But half accept, half not accept. It's pretty cool, isn't it? Pretty wonderful. So we don't find a peace in adulating some being out there, but in this own heart mind that's right here in the floor and the ceiling and the walls. We've been sitting here, some of us, for more than 40 years right here. So this floor and walls are always teaching us the Dharma, always teaching us. Okay, the fourth one. The fourth one is Linchi. Linchi, commonly known as Rinzai. So in the golden age of Chinese Zen, we have the birth of both the Soto and the Rinzai school. Those are the two schools of Zen that are prevalent now in the West. Rinzai and Soto. You go to Rinzai Center or Soto Center all over the country. And all over Japan, too. All over the country and all over Japan. So this is Linchi, Rinzai. This is just a very short one. I, a mountain monk, tell you clearly, there is an authentic person with no rank, always present, not even a hair's breadth away. I, a mountain monk, tell you clearly, there is an authentic person with no rank, always present, not even a hair's breadth away. So, what about that? No rank, no evaluation. Not a hair's breadth away. So close, the stillness. So close. Too close for your mind to get. But here. So what if when I encounter Matt, when I next see Matt in the hallway, and it's not during a retreat, what if I'm just here with him without trying to evaluate him or demonstrate my worth to him or wondering how I can be more empathic with him or trying to figure out what conversation to have to draw him out? What if I'm just there? What if we're just here? What about it? What about it? Oh, that's scary because I should, you know, I want to develop a relationship with him. So I got to say something. Do you have to say something? I shouldn't say something. I have to say something. What should I say? get all entangled. All entangled. Right? Anybody ever experienced this? No. Bring the person of no rank forth, says Lynchy. Bring the person of no rank forth. The man or woman of naked red flesh, says Lynchy. Bring her forth. Bring him forth. So, any concerns about what Matt thinks of me are irrelevant to just being with him. And they are irrelevant to my own worth because I have none. That doesn't mean I'm worthless. A lot of people tell me they're worthless. They're in the trance of worthlessness. That means I have no worth. So everything's worthy, right? Everything's worthy. What couldn't be worthy? The pebbles, the stones, the tiles? What couldn't be worthy? What's not worthy? So, we can just be. We can be the authentic person with no rank. Each of us. That's what these teachers are telling us. So these walls and floors are telling us. So I'm going to close with something from Philip Whalen. Raise your hand if you know who Philip Whalen is. Oh, almost nobody. So Philip Whalen was a great beat poet who then became a Zen priest and in the same lineage. Well, actually, no, in Suzuki Roshi's lineage. I'm in the Katagiri lineage, in the Suzuki Roshi lineage. And he's dead now. And here's a poem he wrote about the golden age of Chinese Zen, which is actually in your announcement. I praise those ancient Chinamen who left me a few words, usually a pointless joke or a silly question, a line of poetry drunkenly scrawled on the margin of a quick splash picture, bug, leaf, caricature of teacher, on paper held together now by little more than ink and their own strength brushed momentarily over it. Their world and several others gone to hell in a handbasket. They knew it, cheered it as it whizzed by and conked out among the busted spring rain cherry blossom wine jars, happy to have saved us all. So that's what I want to say for today. We're saved. Questions, comments? Got a little time before most of you leave and the rest of us go back to our sitting quietly, doing nothing. Gary.
Quick. I raised my hand when you asked who was Philip Whalen. I saw a picture of Philip Whalen sitting with Allen Ginsberg, and he was wearing this thing, and I thought, I gotta get me one of them. But I've never heard of Philip Whalen's poem until you just read it.
You've never heard of what?
A poem by him.
Oh, he's a great poet.
I only knew him by name.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, it sounds like it.
Yeah. Yeah. He died too young. He died in the Bay Area, San Francisco area of AIDS. Too young. Yeah, too young. Yeah, what else, you guys? What else?
You mentioned
Benton, the two of you, starting with Benton.
You mentioned a priest that was on a solo retreat.
Yeah.
And then he talked to his wife.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Oh, well, that's because he left the solo retreat.
Oh.
He ran out in the yard and said, this is too goddamn hard. And his wife was in the kitchen cutting cucumbers, and she said, easy, easy. Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the way I understand it. That's the way I understand it. And then the daughter came along and said, well, look, Mom, it ain't that easy. It's just living. Don't get attached to easy, because as soon as you get attached to easy, you're going to get hit by something, because it's not a secure world. Nothing's secure. Nothing. Yes?
How does one go to hell in a handbasket?
You just want to go to hell in a handbasket?
No, I don't want to, but what does that mean?
Oh, what does that mean? Well, let me read that again, see if I have anything to say about it. Their world, okay, so first he's talking about these ancient Chinamen, these ancient teachers. And then he's saying their world and several others since gone to hell in a handbasket. Well, since everything changes, and we can't depend on anything, first of all, we might go to hell ourselves. Our teachers might go to hell because we're not perfect people. We do things that hurt others, so we might go to hell. But at least if we do it, we can do it in a handbasket. We can do it playfully. We can be totally in the basket and not caught by anything. And then hell's not that bad. Hell's just what it is. Some people call it heaven. Some people call it hell. Some people are smart and say it's purgatory. Who cares? Who cares? Yes. Another way of interpreting it is that these teachings of these teachers, they're just... the teachers are all gone now. So their teaching is, if we duplicate it and try to memorize it, it's artificial. They've gone. They're completely gone. We have to get it in us, in our own way. Only half accepting their teaching. Half getting it in ourselves. Because it's gone to hell in a handbasket. The teaching's all gone. It's all because they're not here. On the other hand, everything's here. They're here. But not the way we want them to. My teacher, I left both of my teachers before they died. Then they died. I thought, oh, geez, stupid Tim. Why'd you do that? It's too late. But it's never too late. Never too late. Just in our head, it's too late. Thank you for the question. Did I satisfy you?
I'm never satisfied.
Good. Good. Excellent. More of that. Yeah.
I noticed when you were talking about the way you were taught when you first started, to me it seems like almost like it was an advanced course in a way. They just, I mean, it was like a, anyway, I just was, because, and I can kind of, see, like, the point of it, but it felt like it was very, very difficult.
Yes. Did you hear what she said? You guys hear? She said it's almost like the way you were taught it was an advanced course. Well, the Tibetans teach, how do you pronounce it? Is it? I can't remember how it is, but they teach shikantaza at the end. First, you go through all, you do shamatha practice, you do vipassana practice, you do breathing practice. And so there was a Tibetan guy who lives downstairs in our house, actually. He came to live with us as a refugee, like, for a couple months, about 12 years ago, and he's still there. I don't know, he's wonderful. But anyway, I told him, he said, oh, you're a Buddhist teacher. I said, yeah, Noang, I'm a Buddhist teacher. She said, oh, very good. You know, they revere Buddhist teachers. And he said, very good. And how do you teach? And I told him what he taught. He said, oh, I told him what my teachers taught. And he said, "Oh, very confusing. You don't do that. You only do that with really advanced people, right?" And I said, "Well, sometimes, but that's not." So, yes, yeah, yes. What's the word? Dzogchan. It's like Shikon tells it. How do you pronounce that? Anybody know Tibetan? That's what they teach. Dogchan, which, but you gotta practice for 20 years first and go through all this other stuff. But this is the way it was taught to us, and we're doing okay. So. Okay, well, thank you.